The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today.
Hello and welcome to The Price of Football, the show that looks at the money behind the beautiful game with me, Kevin Day, and Liverpool University's Kieran Maguire. It's questions day, but we start with some news, and we start with some very sad news. A few days ago, our dear friend, producer Guy, lost his dad after a long illness. So we send Guy, of course, lots of love and hugs from London and Sussex, and I'm sure you'll send him your regards from all over the world. Kieran, he might not even be listening to this, to be fair, in which case it will be going out unedited, so we'd better be very careful for once.
Yes, and whilst we take the mickey out of producer Guy as part of the show, we genuinely love the guy to bits, but yeah, because without him, the show, well, A, the show wouldn't be going because we're so disorganised, and B, I suspect my house would have been repossessed following a few legal cases, because he contacts me at times and says, you know, Kieran, and it's never in anger, it's always in sorrow rather than anger, and he'll contact me and he says, Kieran, that story you said about the club owner and those two prostitutes, the cocaine, the frogman's outfit and the bath full of custard, I just don't think it's a good idea to put that one out. And I'll go, oh, okay, producer guy. So we genuinely love the guy to bits. He is one of the nicest blokes and he's a great family man. So all of our love and best wishes to him and his family.
But then he gets angry over the strangest things, like the birdsong being too loud in Spain. A couple of actual news stories, Kieran, topical. It looks like either UEFA and or the Paris authorities got things very, very badly wrong on Saturday night before the Champions League final. Policing based on reputation is my guess, a reputation that Liverpool fans have long shaken off, but English football fans still have, and some of those scenes of essentially kettling was going on before the game, and it was dangerous, Kieran, wasn't it?
Yes, and it's prejudice. You know, we are. I know this is a football finance show, but you and I, we are both football fans. We've both been on the receiving end of incorrect policing, and also we've been on the receiving end of some absolutely great policing, as well. And there is a hell of a difference. I was fortunate enough to go to the Euro finals in 2016 in Paris, and there it was pretty good, but at the same time, it was France playing at home in the final, so it was less of an issue. Yeah. But the French police, they're not the type you're likely to strike up a conversation with. You know, they do look pretty rough, and you and I are also both old enough to remember when the Met weren't, shall we say, the best friends of football, and they were as much looking up for a scrap as some of the two firms who would be up against each other.
It's football finance, Kieran, as you say. So congratulations to either Nottingham Forest or Huddersfield. We're recording this at 12:30 on Sunday. But one quick question, Kieran, before we get to questions from our listeners. Is Sky's hyperbole still correct? Is the Championship final still the most valuable game in football?
It is, especially in the case of Nottingham Forest, because they're not in receipt of parachute payments. Mm. If they are promoted, therefore, their broadcast revenue from the EFL, they get around about $2.5 million. They get probably about another $4.5 million from the Premier League in solidarity payments. So it will go from seven and a half mil 2. We did the numbers. Norwich got 101 last season, plus 2 years of parachute payments, which are another 75. You lob in increased sponsorship, you lob in increased perimeter advertising, and you know the numbers that Sky are talking are genuine. And if you stay up one season, all of a sudden that becomes 300 million. So it's the richest game in the world, and as such, because the prizes are so big, it's a lottery ticket, and people, in my opinion, overpay for that lottery ticket, and that's why we have the problems that we have today in terms of the championship last season. £120 in wages for every £100 worth of income. Clubs have an incentive to overspend in the championship, and when they get to the Premier League, they think it's going to solve all their problems, but then they realise they've got an incentive to overspend to avoid going back to the championship. So it doesn't actually improve their finances as much as they'd anticipated.
Questions, Kieran. And our first one comes from Andy Hunter. Andy is an Aberdeen fan, or if he's not, he's curiously interested in them. Andy says, could you tell me what you think of Aberdeen's latest figures? I'm slightly concerned that the wages increased from 68% to 85% of turnover due to the impact of COVID. Is this as you would expect, or should I be concerned going forward? Also, how long will we take to recover to a pre-COVID position? And interesting, Kieran, well, you've just talked about championship clubs averaging 120% wages, and theirs is only 85%. So, again, it's more proof that Scottish football seems to be slightly more sensible than us.
It certainly is compared to our championship, that's for sure. With regard to Aberdeen, Andy, you can rest easy, in my view, because whilst the wages to revenue ratio did increase, wages overall fell. Wages, based on my numbers, they're averaging probably around about £4,200 per week. And I think somebody from Aberdeen went to play for a team in the National League who were paying more than that, which I think is we need to do a proper investigation into the National League, because that is turning into another Wild West, in my view.
Sorry, Kieran, can I just interrupt there, Kieran? Sorry, because sure. I spotted a squirrel outside and was slightly distracted. Did you say £4,200 was the average Aberdeen wage in the Scottish Premier League?
In the Scottish Premier League, yeah.
Wow, that's I think that'll come as a surprise to quite a few people, Kieran, because they're building a new ground. They're a team that we, as you say, are not historically short of money. So that's incredibly low, it seems to me.
Well, and that's also the third highest in the Scottish Premiership. You've got Rangers and Celtic who are streets ahead, and that's why it is a duopoly as far as winning trophies is concerned. Aberdeen have a competitive wage structure. There are clubs in the Scottish Premiership who are averaging less than £1,000 a week.
Well, I suppose four grand a week is not a lot. It's £200,000 a year. So it's for most of us mere mortals, it is quite a lot of money. What about Andy's question about how long it will take to recover to pre-COVID position?
I think that Aberdeen will be close to that for 21-22. I know they didn't have the best of seasons on the pitch, but crowds did return. I think the biggest hit that they had in 2021 was in terms of commercial income. But now that fans can return, sponsors can come in, they can buy the merchandise, I think we should be broadly back to where we before. And it will be more dictated by events on the pitch, trying to get those discretionary fans who are thinking, it's November, we're playing a team, St Johnstone at home. What's incentivizing me to go to this match? Have we got the pricing right? Have they got the concourse? And is it a good environment to go? Which I'm sure it is. But this is where the clubs have to work that wee bit harder.
So you've just inadvertently upset a dear friend of mine, Kieran, Scottish comedian Fred McCauley, who's a delightful man, St Johnstone fan, but he's, like most football fans, he has a bee in his bonnet about something, and he always says whenever people are talking about Scottish football, they always say, well, you know, playing St Johnstone on the chair, St Johnstone seems to be the Stoke City. What's it going to be? what are they going to be like playing St Johnstone on a Tuesday night? It's always St Johnstone. He's such a nice man, he'll forgive you quite quickly. Matthew Plant has our next question, and it's one I imagine you would have really enjoyed researching.
I did, I love this one.
It's got so many words in it that are completely up your street, and now I had to look up. So Matthew Plant's question is, ignoring growth on their capital investment, which club owners take the most financially from their club, either by dividends, director emoluments, or commercial contracts with associated companies? Can I guess the Glazers, Kieran?
You are in it in one. It's like getting Wordle in one, Kevin. There, it's excellent. The Glazers are streets ahead, and Manchester United announced their results, their third quarter results, at midday on Thursday. So as you can imagine, I went into spreadsheet heaven, and despite the fact that the club is losing more than £1 million a week, they're still committing to pay a dividend in June to the shareholders. Now the Glazers own around about, you know, probably about 75% of the shares in total, and well over 90% of the votes on the back of that. So the dividend's around about £11.5 million. So the vast majority of that is going to the Glazers. Manchester United have been paying that out since I think it was 2016. So the shareholders do well. And also, you know, whilst Matthew says ignoring growth on their capital investment, what the Glazers have done is that they've sold small tranches of shares, especially in recent years. And just when the Manchester United share price is high, they've cashed in on the back of that, and they've made very, very large sums. Yeah, we are talking into the hundreds of millions, I think, in respect of that. So that is by far the most successful. Second, the runners-up prize goes to West Ham with David Gold and David Sullivan. And remember, I think it was one of the Davids has gone on to the radio and has said forcefully, Kevin, we have never taken a penny out of this club in salaries or dividends. You go, well, that's fair enough, David. Fair enough, David. But just a quick look at these loans that you've got to the club. Yeah. You've charged the club £22 million in interest.
Wow.
So I'd quite happily not take a dividend if I was going to get £22 million in interest. And I know they say, well, you know, it's a lower rate of interest than they think they'll be charged by the banks. But it's still possibly a higher rate of interest than you would get from sticking it in your local ISA. It's a win-win deal. Third, I think it's your good friend, Mr. Parrish.
Really?
I'm assuming that he is the highest paid director at Crystal Palace because he's chief executive. To be fair, you know, when Palace were promoted, didn't take any money out for the first couple of years in the Premier League, but has taken out at least £9 million. We don't know what he's taken out for 2021 because he is on minority step. He is using a loophole to avoid publishing the accounts.
Yeah, well, it may be him. It may be the Americans. We don't know. It's probably him. I don't know. It's slightly annoying doing this pod and Palace are one of the clubs that haven't published their accounts. And this is a sort of question I'm here to ask, Kieran, but why is it important to ignore the growth on the capital investment in answering this question?
Well, because that's sort of a paper profit. So if you've bought a club for £200 million and you've think you could sell it for £300 million doesn't mean that you will. So I think what Matthew's trying to say is, you know, only let's look at those people who have genuinely cashed in their chips.
Thomas McCarthy has asked us a question. On the face of it, it's rather a grim one, and it's a sort of question that football fans do throw to each other from time to time. But it's also an important one, I think. As Thomas McCarthy says, back in 2016, we had the tragic accident where 19 players from Brazilian team Chapecoense died in a plane crash. My question is, what is in place currently if this were to happen to one of our Premier League teams? Is each player insured by the club as per their transfer value and the team is simply compensated for each individual lost? And is there a minimum amount of players that are required to be lost in order for a club season to be suspended? until the next transfer window when they can replace players. Of course, back in the day, Kieran, the Munich air disaster, the FA expected Manchester United to fulfil their very next fixture, which they did with basically youth team players. So I hope that's not the case now, but it was a terrible, terrible, terrible accident. But it's an interesting question.
It is. It is. I managed to speak to one of the travel officers at a Premier League club.
Right.
And he said that they do take out specific insurance policies with regards to this, and the premiums are quite high. But also, he said that what some of the clubs are doing is that they are employing, on a sort of a consultancy basis, risk aviation experts. And they have gone through that process of they worked out, well, if we are chartering flights to an away match, should we actually charter two flights? Because for that very risk, and effectively put 11 players in plane A and 11 players in plane B. And they've also done that with regards to the executives. And I know that certainly working in the world of finance, some banks will not allow more than two very senior bankers to travel on the same train or plane for that very reason. And the clubs have looked into it. They've worked out that it's probably not cost effective to do that, but it's certainly been considered. But what the risk aviation experts do is they actually assess the planes themselves that the clubs are going to play in. So if the plane is more than 25 years old, they'll just say, no, we're not prepared to accept it. But also, if the plane is less than 2 years old, they do exactly the same because they've not worked through the gremlins yet. There is sort of a sweet spot. It's a bit like knocking in a cricket bat. If you've got a cricket bat, the first few innings, it sounds like an old plank, and then you have a few glorious years, and then of course it reaches the end of its life. So that's sort of really intriguing. But what he was also saying is that for players that are on international duty, or if we have a club that's about to recruit a player from overseas, the risk aviation experts have said you do not, because they normally get these lads coming across on private planes. And he says, wait, just look at what happened with Emilio Nicella.
Of course.
So we will not use single propeller planes for that very reason. Yeah. In addition, let's say we've got four or five players playing for Spain or playing in a match, Spain versus France and so on, we want to get our players back as quickly as possible. So we will hire a jet, and then what we will do, so if it's a London club, what you will normally find is that, they might be rivals, but Arsenal and Spurs and Chelsea, they'll have a word with each other, and together they will charter a flight to get their French players back as quickly as possible.
Right.
So there is collaboration taking place. They want to pool the costs, which makes a lot of sense. But the other thing that they would insist on, again, this is coming from the senior clubs, and the Emiliano Sala thing is this is what happens when people try to cut corners. And the tragic loss of life there is. They even said to me, we will only charter a flight, and we'll do our background checks, and we will insist that there is a pilot and a co-pilot. Because you don't want, what happens if, you and I, we're old enough to remember seeing the old 1970s disaster movies, which involved planes, normally where the captain had a dodgy, prawn chimichanga, and then he went ill and so on. And the air hostess had to bring the plane down. He says, if you think of it, you put that in a football context, what happened if we had, for example, we got a single pilot in the plane, he becomes ill or she becomes ill, and you end up with air traffic control having to get Jack Grealish to land the plane. That doesn't bear thinking about, does it?
No, you'd ask the rest of the team first before you got to Jack Grealish, wouldn't you? That's really interesting. My dad, God rest him, was like B.A. Baracus when it comes to aeroplanes. As he said the first time he flew to Ireland, it was a propeller plane, and he looked out the window and one of the propellers wasn't going round. And he decided the only course of action was to wander up to the pilot's cockpit and mention it to him. And the pilot basically was calling my dad to pile. I went, oh, really? Shit. And then went back, had a look out the window, and then did an announcement about perfectly normal, don't worry. But then what I could never understand with my dad, whenever he flew to Ireland, right up to the end, it's like, Dad, if you're so scared of planes, why do you get to the airport 5 hours before your one takes off? Also, Ken, as well, I just think that you just made me laugh a lot then. Only a man of a certain age would compare an aeroplane and a cricket bat. That's the old cricket bat. Yeah, flying a plane. It's just like knocking in a cricket bat. Series, really not similar things at all, Kieran. I understood what you said, and every man of a certain age listening to this would go, oh, yeah, it's a good point. Beth Evans. Hello, Beth. Beth Evans is a business student and works in the football industry and says that she was interested in the discussion surrounding the broadcast blackout. Beth says, I agree with the principal and feel the 3 p.m. Saturday slot should be looked after. However, with media deals getting out of hand, would it not be better served to give Premier League clubs their own Saturday 3 p.m. slot, say 4 p.m. on a Sunday, for example? I raised the point, as I noticed in American football, NFL teams play on a Sunday and college football plays on Saturday. Do we think clubs will have to pursue ideas such as this to continue the injection of money? It's an interesting question, Kieran, because the broadcasting blackout 3 o'clock Saturday is still fairly sacrosanct, but it would seem to make sense in a way. I'd hate it to happen, but if the Premier League had their own specific day, that's not a bad idea, I think.
I can see the logic, and I suspect if I was an EFL club owner or the EFL, I'd be absolutely delighted because Saturday becomes EFL day. And that would increase the value of the rights because we still want to watch something. And I think it would be good and be more attention on the EFL. And you can see the benefits. But the other stakeholders wouldn't be keen on it. And by the other stakeholders, first of all, let's take a look at it from the point of view of the broadcasters. What the Premier League does is it sells individual packages. So it sells a 12:30 p.m. Saturday and a 5:30 p.m. Saturday slot, and it does extract a lot of dollar from those from the broadcasters because they want to have this effectively strap you in, ideally from 7:30 on a Friday night until 10 o'clock on a Monday night. We have, to a large extent, got wall to wall football, and they like the idea of getting viewers and subscribers committing to them for 3 to 4 days over the course of the weekend. So I don't think the broadcasters would be over keen on it, but I think it would be a great idea from the EFL. And I'm the same as you. I'm a traditionalist. 3 p.m. Saturday is great. If it meant that I now, as a fan, and you were both fans of Premier League clubs, if we have to go and turn our attention to every Sunday matches taking place, several things to say. Trains are a bit crap on Sundays. So we're away to Newcastle. If we're away to Burnley on a Sunday, chances are you're not going to get home.
Yep.
There are, and you're saying, well, why are we doing this? We're doing this in order to assist our friends at the EFL. And you'd say, well, I'm not quite sure that it's working. The other issue, which I suspect will push against it, but I absolutely understand where Beth's coming from, is Champions League. Champions League takes place on Tuesdays and Wednesdays.
Of course.
So how can you have matches taking place on a Sunday, which presumably would be 12:30, 2:30, 4:30, 7? You could have four matches on a Sunday if then our leading clubs who were in the Champions League had to then zoom off to go and play somewhere in Europe. So I think for those reasons, it's unlikely to arise. But what we have at present, it's not been thought through logically, and it's sort of a bit of a mess.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hi, I'm Steve Lamack, and every week I'm joined by Music Allies Head of Insight, Stuart Dredge, on The Price of Music, the weekly podcast all about the money behind the music industry. In each episode, we discuss the very latest goings-on in the music business and dig into the finances behind the big stories.
So whether you're a music lover who just wants to know more about what really goes on in the industry, or you're an aspiring musician, manager or label owner who wants some inside knowledge on how Spotify's financial model really works, or what the future holds for independent live music venues, this is a show for you.
Subscribe to The Price of Music in your podcast app now. See you soon.
Our next question comes from Tony Hereford. I presume it's Tony Hereford. Possibly it could be Tony from Hereford. I hope it's Tony Hereford, because he definitely would have been one of our 70s private eyes that we liked to. Trevor Eve would have played Tony Hereford. Probably would have only got one series, but it would have been a great name for a 77. Tony Hereford asks a question that we have answered before, but it's one of those questions that we get asked a lot. So I'm happy to revisit this one. And Tony says, how much does each player pay to the PFA, that's the Players Union, the Professional Footballers Association, in the form of subs? Do they all pay the same, or is it pro rata to earnings?
Right, they all play the same, and I'm indebted to the PFA, because I contacted them on a Sunday morning to ask this question, because I was at a wedding yesterday. Normally I do most of my research work on a Saturday, and fair play to them, they got back to me. And they're absolutely superb. So everybody plays the same. It's £150 per year, or £20 if you're an academy player, if you're coming through the ranks. And you might say, well, is that fair? You know, Kevin De Bruyne and David De Gea and co paying the same as left back in League Two. But yeah, as the PFA point out, first of all, it's a union, a union, everybody is equal. And I'm a trade union member myself, and I pay the same subs as people that earn more than me and less than me and so on. So you know, I understand where they're coming from that point of view. And from their point of view, you might think, well, that's not a lot of money per member. And it's £150. But the PFA generates most of its money from its share of the Premier League TV rights. So therefore, you know, from the PFA's point of view, it's the Premier League players who are indirectly generating the vast majority of the money, and they're effectively subsidising all of the good work that the PFA does. And you know, I'm not here to be a cheerleader of the PFA just because they answered a question on Sunday morning, even though I think it's hats off to them for doing it. But they do an awful lot of good work for all of their members in terms of health, education, legal advice, and so on. And that is, again, that is on a universal basis, and also when the players have ceased to be professional players themselves.
Yeah, I think it's an indication of how highly most players hold the PFAs. I know two or three young footballers who play semi-professional, fairly high non-league level, and all of them, their ambition is to get a professional contract so they can join the PFA, because they all feel that they'd be much safer in their terms of employment if they were part of the PFA. James Barterby has a question. James Barterby's question, I think, is probably germane to Brighton at the moment. As you see, clubs often pay compensation to bring in a manager from another club. But what's stopping a manager resigning in order to move on? Do they have clauses in their contracts to say they can't take a new job for a set period if they quit, or a compensation clause they have to pay to break their contract? And I believe, Kieran, that Newcastle are waiting to employ your Brighton's ex-technical director, who is currently serving out his notice with Brighton, I believe. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah, Dan Ashworth.
Yeah.
I think we will have white smoke on that deal coming through this week.
Right.
If the rumours are true, but in respect of a manager's contract of employment, it will be for a fixed period of time, and if the manager chooses to resign, then they would, the club is at liberty to insist that they sit out a period of gardening leave.
Yeah.
And now how can we alleviate that? You alleviate that through financial compensation. So in the case, you know, again, going back to Brighton, Graham Potter
signed a contract with Swansea City when he joined the club, and we approached Swansea after he'd been there for 12 months, and said, well, we'd like to terminate his contract early and recruit him as manager, and a settlement period was organised. Now, and that all went through smoothly. If the manager resigned, then he still has a contract of employment, which will contain clauses which will insist that if he chooses to take another position within the industry, then there must be some form of financial settlement. So you can't just quit and say, oh, no, I'm fed up of football, and then 48 yeah. hours later say, I've rediscovered my love for the game at another club with another transfer. So, you know, the contracts are there for reasons. They are to protect both parties. And you know, I've had the privilege of doing some work for the League Managers Association, and you know, you talk to managers, and they say, well, you know, the average period of tenure in some of the divisions in football is 12 to 14 months. You know, if I sign a 3-year contract, I'm not necessarily going to leap away, but I've still got family, I've still got kids, I've still got mortgage, and you know. Managers, especially in the lower leagues, are paid far less than people suspect that they're going to be. And they need protecting. And if they prove to be good and another club comes in, that's great. I mean, if we take the case of Lincoln City and the Cowley brothers, they went to Huddersfield. Huddersfield paid compensation.
Mm.
Everybody wins.
Mm. Well, except Huddersfield for quite some time, but there you are. Lee Hine is a Colchester United fan living in Germany, which led me to a 2-minute romantic speculation that one day Lee will be travelling through maybe Stuttgart. He'll be in Stuttgart, and he'll be in a bar, and he'll look up and he'll go, hang on a second, I recognise that kit. And the other Colchester United fan living in Germany will be in the bar, and they will have many happy hours talking about life back in Colchester. But Lee's question is about work permits for managers in the Premier League and the EFL. And Lee says, I remember reading that Antonio Conte had to wait before taking charge of training at Spurs, and Ralf Rangnick missed the Chelsea game due to his permit not being in place. My question is, with many out-of-work managers in the UK, what do clubs have to provide to apply for work permits for foreign managers, and what is the process for approval? This is a question that I think Sam Allardyce would happily have asked in recent months, because it's one that disgruntled English managers often talk about, isn't it?
Yes. Now, since the decision to leave the European Union, we no longer have freedom of movement of labour within Europe. So now there has to be effectively Foreign Office approval and what's referred to as a governing body endorsement. So the recruiting club has to, via the authorities, indicate that the person that they are recruiting for the job has a special skill set which would enable them to do the job here in the UK. So it is a case of going through. There would be perhaps a points-based system. If you were the manager of a fourth division club in Albania, are you going to get a job as a championship manager? Probably not, because you're unlikely to satisfy the criteria. So you have to go through a skill set. We do have a points-based system in terms of recruiting people to work here in the UK, and that would normally be done, you know, via the auspices of the club, perhaps the LMA themselves, if the manager previously worked in this country, and so on.
Now, a couple of weeks ago, Kieran, we asked a question from Benjamin Toast. And we had many people tweeting in to say, hang on a second, how come Benjamin Toast gets all these questions answered? Is he producer guy in disguise? we don't know. We've yet to ascertain that. But also, this question comes from Larkin Hogel. And Larkin gets a lot of questions answered. So it's possible that Guy's using more than one pseudonym. For new listeners, it may not surprise you to hear that Larkin Hogel is, in fact, Australian. It's probably the most Australian name you could have. Well, I went to see Craig Revel-Horwood the other night perform. It was fantastic. He had some great Australian expressions. Larkin, even better in the after-show party, I have to say, but there you are. Larkin Hogel said, is there any special clause or feature in player contracts that would allow teams to not pay them during the African Cup of Nations? Many players miss at least 2 Premier League matches during that tournament. Are clubs obliged to release and pay players regardless – of how the international fixtures disrupt a domestic campaign. And I don't know about you, Kieran, but we regularly lose three or four players during AFCON. But actually, we don't mind because we know how important it is for players to represent their country. And we're also quite proud of the fact that we've got players that are taking part in that tournament. And of course, it gives you an extra level of interest. So yeah, it's only a couple of games, so it's annoying. But actually, you kind of go, no, it's fair enough. It's part of being the supporter of a Premier League game. But it's an interesting question.
It is. As far as Larkin's question in relation, could the clubs avoid paying the players? Well, try recruiting them. Mm. Now, try offering them a contract which says you're of African heritage. We want to pay you so much per month, but if you go and play for your country in a prestigious tournament, we're not going to play you during that period of time. And the player says, thanks, but no thanks. I'll go and join somebody else instead. So yeah. I think clubs have to be practical and pragmatic when it comes to this. Ultimately, what we're doing here is governed by FIFA. And under FIFA statute, if you are chosen to play for your country, then that takes priority over domestic games. Now, remember, if there's a certain number of players that get picked within a tournament or for individual matches, you might be able to, and this sometimes happens, remember sometimes when in League One and League Two games during international breaks, say, well, why aren't Sunderland playing this weekend? Yeah. And it turns out that they've got four or five players that have been called up. Yeah. So if you go through a particular threshold, then there could be consequences in terms of actually having the matches played, which won't necessarily go down with the coach or the fans particularly well. But that should be something that you take into consideration when you are putting together a squad, because the last thing you want is lots of matches concertina together. But it is dictated by FIFA, it's country over club. And as a football fan, as a legacy fan, I'm totally in favour of that.
Absolutely, yes, absolutely right. Our penultimate question comes from Ben Andrew. And Ben, if you don't mind, I'm going to do a little bit of judicious pruning of your question for exactly those legal reasons we talked about earlier on. Producer Guy's got enough on his mind at the moment without this sending his blood pressure further up. Ben Andrew says, unfortunately, football has seen a recent spike in players being arrested and having their contracts ripped up due to gross misconduct. Allegedly, the next bit is redacted because he names a couple of teams who have had players arrested and are not included in their squad for the season. Can teams admit the millions in wages from FFP, including it's halfway through the season, if a player has their contract ripped up due to gross misconduct? I appreciate this isn't the most important part when it comes to these players, but we're talking tens of millions of pounds. And as somebody who writes and Have I Got News For You, and it took me a long time to understand this, it turns out that just adding the word allegedly, Kieran, doesn't save you from prosecution, as we have found, as I in particular found one joke about a member of the royal family.
That's for after the show chat.
I think you can probably guess which member of the royal family it is, but there you are. That's why, Ben, I didn't mention the teams. But it is an interesting question. I mean, it is happening, but can they offset it against FFP?
If the contract is terminated due to gross misconduct, then there's no obligation to pay any more money. So therefore, the club will be in the clear. With reference to the possible players for the possible clubs for the possible indiscretions that I think Ben is referring to, as far as I understand, all of those players are still under contract and will continue to be so until the due force of law has taken place. If the club unilaterally decided to terminate the contract without the player being found guilty in a court of law of a discretion, then if I was the PFA and if I was the player's representatives, I would sue the club because it would be a case of guilty until found otherwise, as far as the club was behaving. We are aware clearly of some players who may have done some things where they are not in team photos, they are not mentioned in the programs, and so on. And social media deals with that type of nonsense. That's not nonsense. That trial by social media element of things. But it would not be force majeure from an FFP perspective. So given that COVID was not deemed to be a sufficient reason, once in a century long pandemic, did not allow clubs to evade financial fair play accusations, I think the behaviour or misbehaviour of an individual is unlikely to do the same as well.
Mm. Our final question, Kieran, comes from Paul Doddymead, and it's one of those questions that I love because it's one of those questions where you go, why haven't I asked this before? And it's a topical subject. It's one of your favourites. And Paul says, after years of poor ownership and a lack of cost control, it looks like these things are going to lead to the creation of a new regulator, an independent regulator. Paul says, typically, most regulators are funded by the industries they regulate. Mm. Is there any way fans won't have to pick up the cost through their ticket prices? And for supporters of well-run teams, why do they have to pay? A very interesting question, I think, Kieran.
It is, and I absolutely understand where Paul has come from. And, I have to... In the world of being as transparent as possible, I know people that work in terms of drafting the legislation and so on with regards to this, and I've had round robin meetings for discussions with them, and I my personal view is if there's a regulator, my personal view is light touch, have it focused, have it tailored rather than an over bureaucratic approach. And certainly, if you take such a system to football regulation, that stops the attack dogs which are being employed by the Premier League. And all I would say is that there is an extremely well-measured and analytical article written by the Charlton dossier in relation to one of these attack dogs. That are trying to discredit the potential for a regulator in the game. But back to Paul's question, there will be compliance costs. Now, we don't know how much that those are going to be. We've been talking about the stakeholders who have benefited from the game in terms of owners and chief executives. I don't think that even if the regulator has a significant number of employees, they themselves will not be on big salaries. So spread over the total industry, I don't think it will be huge. But is there a way that fans can avoid picking up the cost through their ticket prices? Right now, I'm back on soapbox. There should be a football levy on all bets in the same way that there is a levy in relation to the horse racing industry. Yeah. Because the horse racing industry provides huge amounts of employment, provides huge amounts of enjoyment for people that enjoy it, and so on. And the gambling industry benefits from the horse racing industry. The gambling industry is the single biggest beneficiary of the success of the Premier League from a financial perspective. Mm. If you take a look at the Gambling Commission's website and see the level of bets which are placed on football and the margins that the gambling industry gets. So by having a levy on football bets, this could A, fund the regulator from the very smallest of small change. B, it could provide a little bit of money for the Treasury. And I think Mr. Sunak is if he's looking at the money coming in and the money coming out, there's a bit of a gap there. Mm. And thirdly, and this is my view, is that a significant proportion of it should go to both the EFL and grassroots football to protect the history and the heritage elements of the game itself. And the gambling companies would still make a hell of a lot of money. So that would be the solution that I would suggest, Paul. And I think that it is an equitable one. So that because those who have benefited the most from the game can now start to contribute back to the game.
Do you know what, Kieran? You mentioned the Chancellor. I think it's time for us to rectify a glaring omission. We forgot to congratulate him on being entering the Times Rich List. That was very remiss of us. It's end of season.
And producer Guy as well, of course.
Well, I think he's on his own list, isn't he? It's the end of the season, so it's time for another Price of Football Zoom quiz, although, of course, our season doesn't end. We're not going anywhere. But to celebrate what's been a remarkable season, we're having a Zoom quiz, which we always enjoy. It's taking place this Thursday, June the 2nd, 7:30, I believe, or 7, I don't know, it'll be on the link. We're not posting the link on social media this time, so we can avoid the dickheads who hover around. instead, you can find the link in the description of this episode on your podcast app. Hope to see you there. And thanks to everyone who's donated to the pod via our Patreon page. If you'd like to join them and make a small monthly contribution to the always free-to-air pod, go to patreon.com/priceoffootball. And if you have a question you'd like answered on the show, email us at questions@priceoffootball.com. And in the meantime, I shall hand you over to the company, Mr. Kieran Maguire, for his customary farewell.
Well, as always, folks, thank you so much for the support for the show. It genuinely warms the cockles of our hearts. Patreon is one method of doing that for us, for as little as a pound a month. Then you think about that, but that works out at what, 12p an episode for some of the amazing insight that we managed to produce by phoning up other people and asking them to answer our questions.
Hang on, I'm still busy. I'm too busy doing the mental arithmetic on dividing a pound by 8. You're the accountant. You do that, Kieran.
Yeah, that's what I said. 12p an episode.
Is it? But isn't 12p? You've got 4p unaccounted for then, now, haven't you?
Well, yeah, I'm rounding down.
Oh, okay. All right. Let's not round down, Kieran. Let's round up. let's join the Conservative Party and round everything up. Let's level up, not level down.
Sorry, true.
Yeah.
But if you don't think we deserve that, we perfectly understand why belts are tight and so on. You can give us some love. You can give us some groovy vibes and karma by going on to your podcast app and giving us a review. And if you give us 5 stars, you think we're worth it, that would be much appreciated. It does help us in the charts. We are punching against our weight. This is very much a niche show, but we're up against some big hitters. And by all accounts, this has been confirmed by producer guy and other people we work with, it doesn't matter what you write in the review. You could say you would rather this show was presented by Cher and Les Dawson, and it wouldn't make a blind bit of difference. I've got no idea where I've got those. I get these people coming into my head when I'm out walking the dog in the morning. But I think a Cher and Les Dawson published show would be absolutely fascinating, and I'd certainly listen to it and give it 5 stars as well.
Yeah, there's currently a tribute show to Cher going on at the moment with 3 actresses playing Cher, and the young Cher looks exactly the same as the old Cher, which is somebody pointed out is really accurate. And if you're a fan of Les Dawson, by the way, Ali, my wife, is working on a show about him for the Edinburgh Festival.
Oh, really?
Yes, which John Coleshaw is doing, which looks...
I love Les Dawson.
Oh, well, you will love this show then, because they're doing some pre-Edinburgh stuff. If they're anywhere near you, I'll let you know. But I've seen clips of it, and it's really, really good. It's a really clever show. So, yes, we'll see you on Thursday for the next pod, and hopefully we'll actually see you in person for the quiz. So in the meantime, goodbye, everybody, and big love to Guy.
Bye.
The Price of Football. Price of Football.